Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our second concurrent session of the morning. Hopefully everyone's enjoyed the first session and the plenaries. And we're now ready to hear about hybrid, electric and driverless cars, innovation driving change in motor insurance. So our speakers today are going to be Jenna Cook from Suncorp and Scott Duncan and Catherine Weston from Taylor Fry. Jenna, Scott and Catherine have a keen interest in technology, its impact on society, and what this may mean for the future of the general insurance industry. Specifically, they're interested in innovation and the opportunities and challenges this presents to the community. Between them, they have experience across a range of general insurance areas, including pricing, reserving, portfolio monitoring, and capital management. Said Jenna is currently a senior actuary in pricing and monitoring at Suncorp, and Scott and Catherine are consultants at Taylor Fry. A couple of housekeeping points just before I get them started on their talk. We will have time for questions at the end, so we're looking at 25 to 30 minutes of speaking, followed by about 10 to 15 minutes of questions. If when you're asking questions, you could come to the central microphone at the front, state your name and then your question, that would be fantastic, and try and keep the questions to about 2 minutes. Also, please do remember, this is the opportunity to send your feedback to the GI seminar via your mobile or iPad. And please do feel free to take advantage of the opportunity. With that, I'll hand over to Jenna and Scott.
I'd just like to begin by saying this presentation is a collection of our thoughts on how technology has impacted insurance and is likely to impact insurance. We certainly don't have any answers, but these are just our considerations at this time. The presentation looks at both property damage and bodily injury, and it focuses on motor vehicle insurance. We start by examining previous technological advances and how they've impacted claim frequency and claim severity. We then move on to the present and consider telematics and hybrid and electric vehicles. And we focus in this area on greater data capture and any changes in sort of behaviour that we'd expect from groups of people that take up these options. And then finally, we look to the future and consider driverless cars and insurance. I'd like to begin the presentation by posing a question. If I could have a show of hands, who thinks they drive a pretty technologically advanced car? So by that I mean it responds to the environment without your input. So a reverse camera is certainly one example. Windscreen wipers that go on with the rain. Does anyone own an advanced car? It's more than I expected. But it turns out that a lot of us do have this technology in our cars already. ABS has been around for quite some time now, and it responds to the environment, the driving environment. So realistically, what we're presenting here and what we move on to later in the presentation surrounding driverless cars really isn't that much of a leap when we compare it to what we currently have. Now, I won't spend much time on this slide, but I'd just like to say that this process and this development has been underway for since cars were introduced. But a lot of this technology has impacted claim frequency and claim severity. There's been very little challenge to the concept of fault, and there's been little in the way of grouping events together, and I'll expand on that later on. Some perils have been affected more than others, and these include at-fault collision, not-at-fault collision, and theft. Storm and hail, obviously less so. I'd like to hand over to Catherine now, who's going to take you through the present considerations, and she's going to discuss three main areas, being telematics, hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles, and how they impact insurance.
Thanks, Scott. The term telematics describes the use of technological devices to transmit information over long distances. So this clearly encompasses a wide range of technology across many industries. Today I'll be referring to vehicle telematics, which is essentially a black box in your car. It captures data for pay-as-you-drive and pay-how-you-drive insurance. Pay-how-you-drive insurance uses data such as mileage, location and time of day to determine premiums. Pay-how-you-drive insurance captures data such as speed, acceleration, braking and steering to determine premiums. So the less you drive your car and the less erratically you drive your car, the lower your premiums will be. By now, many of you may have looked at the slides and you'll be wondering what CYD stands for. It stands for Control Your Driving. So where pay as you drive and pay how you drive is simply data collection, Control Your Driving interacts with the driver. Control Your Driving provides feedback to improve driving. It's like a constructive backseat driver. So how widespread is vehicle telematics? Well, according to ABI research, worldwide insurance subscriptions were $5.5 million at the end of 2013. However, currently, according to Insurance Telematics Australia, there are over 89 million insurance telematics users worldwide. That's quite a jump up in that space of time. So what are the advantages for insurers? Insurers can attract the safest drivers. The question, are you willing to have a black box in your car, is a rating factor in itself without even any data collection. Once data collection begins, a clear advantage is more accurate pricing. The data can also assist with the faster reporting of claims, more accurate case estimates, the faster management of claims, reduced claims cost and disputes, and reduced fraud. It can also be a launch pad for other services, such as traffic alerts, collision warning systems, anti-theft, fuel consumption analysis, post-accident services, and if everyone had a black box in their car, could be used for traffic optimisation. Don't be the one left in neutral or you'll start going in reverse. What does this mean? If you're the only insurer not offering telematics, you could well be losing your best customers to those who are. But telematics is taking off slowly in Australia. There is an upfront cost of technology. However, the main concern seems to be regarding customer privacy. So considering the popularity of things like location services on your mobile phone, Facebook, credit card use, these are all commonly used with their own privacy issues, but one could conclude that telematics could also very quickly become the norm. Another advance in technology has been the hybrid car. Hybrids combine an electric motor and battery with a conventional petrol motor. The electric battery can be recharged with the petrol motor or also using regenerative braking. There are two main advantages. There's less impact on the environment and there's potential for cost savings over the car's lifetime. Hybrids are more expensive up front. However, the savings come from lower fuel consumption. Hybrids accounted for 1% of all cars sold in 2013 and they're now produced across a whole spectrum of car shapes and sizes. So what we're looking at here is a 708 kilowatt Ferrari hybrid and it can accelerate from 0 to 100 in less than 3 seconds. Still on the topic of hybrids, I'll draw your attention to the table below the graph. Can everyone see the table below the graph? With all other rating variables held constant, the table shows the differences in premiums for hybrid cars versus petrol cars for the two models shown. And you can see in 7 out of the 8 cases, the hybrid is more expensive to insure. However, we would expect this given the higher sum insured. And now to the graph. If we hold the sum insured constant, the graph shows the ratio of hybrid cars to petrol cars. A rating of 1 would indicate no difference in premiums. So we can see that in most cases, hybrids are cheaper to insure than the petrol counterparts once the sum insured is normalised. So given the impact on the environment of hybrid cars, one theory is that the drivers of hybrids are more socially responsible and therefore safer drivers. Some car manufacturers have removed the petrol motor altogether and produced fully electric vehicles. They are significantly more expensive than hybrids and petrol cars and have a shorter driving range, However, they have rapid acceleration due to instant torque. For example, the Tesla's Roadster can accelerate from 0 to 100 in 3.7 seconds. But with limited data, it's difficult to assess the insurance implications of electric cars. However, given the results of our hybrid analysis, it is possible that premiums, normalised for some insured, could be lower again for electric cars. We're now going to see what happens when we remove the driver. So I'll hand over to Jenna and Scott.
Nissan recently announced that it would deliver a commercially viable driverless car by 2020. In addition, there's been a number of studies and an auto industry consultant projected that at the end of 2015, there would be 0.0% of all car sales would be driverless. At the end of 2025, 0.2%. And at the end of 2035, 9%. So there's a dramatic, there's an expectation there that driverless cars will certainly increase in popularity and affordability. So what is a driverless car? They process their environment using a system of lasers, GPS units and cameras. And what's displayed to the picture on the right is a Google Lexus driverless car. They're capable of scanning object movement and responding to given driving conditions. Now, as I mentioned previously, Google is one of the leaders in this area. However, traditional car manufacturers are also pursuing this technology, but they're taking a little bit more of an incremental approach and focusing on highway driving and sort of getting that embedded first. Despite this, some people believe that the introduction of fully autonomous vehicles anytime soon is pure science fiction. And the reasons that they give for that is that currently driverless cars are unable to distinguish between a newspaper on a road and a young child. They'll respond to both those items, for want of a better word, the same. The second reason is that they rely on detailed maps. So anywhere that the driverless car can go must be mapped, and that poses significant issues when it comes to sort of supermarkets and driveways and just the sheer volume of detailed maps that are required to be produced. But let me ask you this. 10 years ago, did you think a vehicle would be able to park itself or reverse park itself? That's the state of development in this area.
Yes, yeah, so as Scott said, essentially Google cars, while many people think, you know, they're an act of science fiction, are actually not as far away as we think. In fact, in two to three, I think, US states, it's already legal to drive a Google car. And I think that that's probably a good indication of how fast this technology is really developing. So what we do know is that approximately 90% of all motor vehicle crashes are caused, at least in part, by human error. So if we take the driver out of the equation, obviously this does have the implications to completely reshape the motor industry, and particularly motor insurance. So if we take the driver out of the equation, what will this mean for claims? Well, obviously, we should have a much reduced frequency. No more small little dingers where you're trying to put your makeup on in the car in the morning, hopefully. You can just get the car to drive and you can put on your whole face a slap. The other thing is that what we expect is that while in the short term we expect costs to increase because of the increased cost of repair for these more advanced vehicles, if you think about the rate of technology and the rate at which this brings down costs, for example, your TV at home, we expect that over time this will become more and more affordable and costs will actually reduce. So basically, what does this mean? We've got reducing frequency, potentially reducing costs. Obviously, we then assume we're going to end up with reducing premiums. So these research technology consultants called Salent, who are based in the US, projected that by the middle of the next decade, premiums could reduce by as much as 60%. That seems a little extreme to me, but still, I mean, it gives you a ballpark figure of the fact that we're not talking an insignificant amount of premium here. The other thing that could happen is as claims become more and more infrequent, people could elect to self-insure. This is always a concern, I suppose, for the insurance industry. Obviously, the timing and the severity of these impacts are obviously still very uncertain and will largely depend on the take-up of Google cars. So more so even than consumer sentiment on I don't want a robot driving my car, I think the main things that will influence this take-up are really around government regulations and more particularly any sort of ANCAP requirements for five-star ratings. As we've seen with things like ABS, as soon as that becomes a requirement for five-star, it becomes completely standard throughout many of the fleets that are being produced. So I think overall, we know that Google cars are really a great idea for society, less traffic, less pollution, safer, potentially lower insurance premiums, and who doesn't love that? However, for most of us in this room, our salaries are probably paid for, at least in part, by insurers. And who this doesn't sound great for is probably insurance companies, if we're having less premiums. So the question becomes, where do insurers look to replace this reducing and declining premium from motor insurance? To me, there are sort of two different approaches that you can take. One is really trying to improve your existing portfolio experience, and a lot of that can be done through data. So Catherine already alluded to this earlier with telematics. That's just a great opportunity to improve the profitability and the selection in your current portfolio and also to expand into other non-traditional offerings such as car repair and being the first on the spot. So I won't dwell too much on that. The second opportunity, which I think is probably the most important one for insurers looking to get ahead, is in terms of new product opportunities. Obviously, while the legislation and regulatory environment is still very unsettled around Google cars, it's difficult to know where this might end up. To me, there is a lot of moral questions that come out around the Google cars. So as Scott said, your car is going to swerve to avoid a newspaper as well as a child. What happens if you're about to swerve into an oncoming school bus to miss the child? I mean, there's a lot of questions that really come up, which makes me feel that this legislative and regulatory environment has a way to go in order to regulate a lot of this. But given that we've already got some legalized states in America having Google cars, I don't think it's really that far away. So new product opportunities, I can see sort of three sort of key areas in which this could progress. One is in terms of a Google car sort of fleet insurance. So if we think about taxi services at the moment, obviously they rely on a driver. But if we had Google cars, you could have a whole fleet of cars at your beck and call able to drive you around. And I can see that this system already sort of exists with things like GoGet, where people subscribe into a pool, have a whole fleet of cars at their disposal, can move around the city easily. So if we moved to having a fleet of Google cars, for example, this could expand opportunities in the commercial fleet area of insurance and allow people to recoup premiums that way. Secondly, I think if we think about how Google cars are built, obviously it's very, very reliant on the programming that sits behind the cars. And this, of course, is produced by people. And whenever you have people in a system or in a chain, that's obviously the weakest link. So Google cars will not be infallible. The upshot of this is that there can still be car crashes that will occur with Google cars. And if the car crashes, who will pay? If your car crashes and you haven't lifted a finger and it's gone off and done something silly of its own accord, is it really your fault? Or is it the fault of the manufacturer who installed the software? Or is it the fault of the computer programmer putting the software together? So there's a lot of questions that still need to be answered around the liability. Existing product liability laws really point to the manufacturer as being the one who would be held responsible in this situation. If that were to occur, I can imagine that there would be a huge change in the nature of claims coming out of motor vehicle accidents into more of a product liability space. What this would mean is a reducing frequency of claims, but also an increasing average claim size. It would also give rise to more exposures to catastrophic-style events where bugs could cause widespread damage and also give rise to the potential for terrorism attacks where people could indeed hack the software and cause huge damage, not to alarm anyone. But I think the question for insurers is, do we want to be insuring that? And if so, how can we really price for it? And the third area that I can see as a possibility is, I suppose, bringing on from what Estelle was saying earlier, from insuring the tangible asset to the intangible. So historically, we've all insured our cars and we've all insured the journey that we have with our cars. But instead of insuring based on a particular piece of equipment, could we move to insuring more of the journey? And the way that I see this working is more like a travel insurance style of setup, where you could even build in deductibles for delays if your Google car turned up late. So I think overall the technology and the change and the regulatory environment is extremely uncertain, and that's true. But I think what is certain is that insurers and actuaries really need to start positioning themselves to start thinking about the implications so that we're ready to take advantage of them when they come up, because this technology is not waiting for anyone. I'll hand back over to Scott to wrap it up.
In conclusion, we see the following key areas as pivotal and vital going forward. Greater use of data. We're seeing this already, not just in telematics, but also building up a complete sort of profile of the customer. We predict that if driverless cars do gain traction, that there'll be a decline in motor insurance premiums. But there will be offsets elsewhere. In order for insurers to stay on top of their game, they'll have to innovate and have to adjust to this more sort of lower claim frequency, potentially higher claim severity environment. And there are also questions around transition as well. If you have a mix of driverless and non-driverless cars on the road, that may be an interesting dynamic. We see autonomous vehicles in some form becoming a reality. That statement that I referred to earlier, Nissan certainly do, and we share that opinion. But their proliferation will greatly depend on society's acceptance of technology and the rules surrounding their operation. I cannot emphasise that point enough, that it really depends on how society responds to this. Insurers have an enormous opportunity here. Some people are maybe pessimistic about the disruption driverless cars may impose, but it's an opportunity for insurers to innovate, respond, and succeed in this new environment. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott, Catherine and Jenna. I'm now going to open the floor up to any questions. As a gentle reminder, if you do have a question, please put your hand up and then get you to come to the microphone in the centre of the room. And a reminder, state your name before asking the question as well. The session is being recorded, so it's just helpful for us in context. Yep, let's start. Estelle and then Elaine.
Estelle Pearson. Oh, very low mic. I'll pick it up. Estelle Pearson. With the take-up of telematics, obviously the price equation is one of the issues there. Do you think that the fact that in Australia we have the bodily injury component separated from the property component, and we have significant cross subsidies between the good and bad risks there, do you think that that will have an impact on the take up of telematics, or do you think that that system would have to change itself to really enhance that take up?
Hello. Hello. Yes, I think it's working now. So I think that's a really good question, and it's quite difficult to know at this point in time. My personal opinion is that you'd still have a good take-up if people felt that, as Catherine alluded to, you could control your risk and control your premium, because I think if anybody's here for the personas, there are a lot of drivers who like to be in control of their premiums and their insurance destiny. So I think that if you can tie it back into incentivized premium reductions, then you can still get a good take-up. I believe that obviously CTP being a regulated environment makes that a lot more difficult, and potentially it would rely on government mandation to try and make this uptake of technology a little bit more widespread. I don't know if you guys agree or have any questions. Sorry, did that answer your question?
Elaine Collins, thank you for a very interesting presentation. I was wanting to ask a question around the transition period, because it's going to be so difficult to have some cars on the road that are driverless and some cars that aren't driverless. I was under the impression that legislation was more likely to follow the path of a certain area of a city being only driverless than other. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that, and I'm also interested in your thoughts on if that doesn't happen in the transition period, there may actually be more accidents than there've ever been because half the cars are driverless and half aren't, until we get to the utopia of all driverless cars and then accident levels go down. So I'm interested in your thoughts on both of those. Thank you.
I should probably stress that these are just my thoughts. I think the practical outworking of it would be very hard to have a component of a city that's just driverless cars. I think it's inevitable that you'd have to have some kind of integration there. Would a driverless car just treat another vehicle on the road as an object that it has to avoid? So I think the transition period certainly does throw up a lot of challenges, but I just don't see it being practical to divide the city in half, so to speak.
Yeah, I completely agree with the transition period. It would be very difficult. If you think about just the simple action that many drivers do every single time they drive, and it's things like merging into traffic, merging lanes, especially in Sydney, there's other complexities that the data would really have to keep up to date with, no right turns which are in certain times of the day. Things in a transition period like that, it's almost as if you'd have to have an entire restructure of the roads and the road rules for that to work. Otherwise, block off certain areas of the city, have certain areas of driverless, and that way, you know, it would actually be, it would be more viable.
I just thought I'd add that I know that in some of the states in the US, they are looking into driverless cars just being allowed on highways and sort of main thoroughfares rather than in peak city areas, for that very reason, that it's quite difficult. And I do know, I was talking to a colleague of mine who was lucky enough to go in a Google car on the Autobahn in Germany, and he said that obviously he was in a Google car, but most other people weren't. And the way that the car responded was just amazing. It managed to sense all of its environment. There was a car that was driving a little bit over the line on the right, and the Google car instantly managed to sense it, slow down, and navigate through that sort of obstacle. So I think that Google cars are actually even smarter than I think a lot of us give credit for. And where the technology exists, I think that they probably won't produce higher accidents at this stage, provided that the mappings do exist. So I think driving in city areas is always fraught with danger to begin with all of the taxi drivers running around. But sorry, if anyone's a taxi driver. I think that, it depends on where they're used, certainly. I think that in places like highways, it's really built for Google cars. When you think of everybody using cruise control anyway, I think that that's a very good starting point to start to realise how they can interact with other cars and how safe it is to start bringing them into suburban and city areas.
My name's Mary. I just wanted to know, aside from sort of making insurance premiums cheaper, what are the other attractions of sort of driverless vehicles? Like, for example, just thinking, well, most of us could probably drive, but there are probably sections of society who can't drive. So, for example, you know, say my parents get older, they probably can't see as well, so they can't drive as easy as they used to be. Do you see what areas do you see the demand for driverless cars coming from?
There's also an extension to driverless cars where currently there are a lot of car sharing arrangements in place. Now, if a driverless car is driverless, technically it could get around without anyone in it. So it could almost be like a taxi service and or a car sharing arrangement. So that's one extension of driverless cars.
I think the licensing regulation is going to be really interesting around it. I think one of the moral questions that people have posed as well is, in corollary to older people in the society, what about the younger people? Say that you don't have time to drop your kids at daycare. Can you just chuck them in the back and program the car to go to daycare? And I think that that's an interesting one because obviously if something goes wrong, who's going to overwrite the car? And I think that that's still one of those big moral questions where they're talking about, do you need to have a scanner device in the car so you need to have a valid license to then operate the car? And I think that that's something that still needs to be fleshed out because from a moral point of view, you know, is it safe to put people in these cars that can't overwrite things? I think most of the way that these cars are operating at the moment is that often the laws require you to be sitting in the driver's seat with a finger on the wheel at least. You don't even need a whole hand, but you need at least a finger on the wheel so you can overwrite. And I think that that's something that at this stage is still a little bit far away to be able to just program the cars and stick people in them and send them off. But, I mean, I think that's an exciting piece of development that could come in the future depending on how the technology is programmed. But I think it's still got to overcome a lot of moral questions, which will then give way to laws around licensing and things like that. But, yeah, interesting.
Just very briefly, there may also be benefits for society, not just the individual. If you're able to place more cars closer together on a road, require less lanes, there's benefits not just for the individual, but it does have potential wider benefits as well.
Excellent. Yep.
The observation I'll probably make on that is that I think it gives rise for opportunities too. I'm quite optimistic about your presentation. Transport industries, I think, in the future would be good adopters of this. But my comment is that I think Australia in general have been slow adopters to this type of technology because the average age of a car in Australia is probably, what, 70% older than 10 years and what have you. So I'm just probably hesitant to how well the Australian public would adopt this over time. Given that we all like to have a culture of owning a car and so forth, and the average age probably spans out 4 to 5, 7 years, and we tend to sometimes change over our cars, and not necessarily in a new way either. The other opportunity too, as I see for reinsurers, is given some of the liability issues there, I'm not too sure as an industry as to how we confront that when we're reinsuring that particular catastrophe type of events.
Thanks for your comment. I'll just add something about the Australian industry regarding telematics. Currently, there are only two providers offering telematics insurance. However, the theory behind telematics, which is pay as you drive, there is another separate insurer offering pay as you drive, and it's on a trust-based system. So it's actually not requiring the black box in your car. So it's almost as if Australia is embracing, you know, ideas, but we're just lagging a little bit behind in the technology.
Yeah, I think too that generally Australia does tend to lag behind a lot of the world. I mean, if you think about things like Facebook, the rest of the world seemed to have it a year or two before we did. So I don't know that it's necessarily just the cars either, though I think that the costs of importing cars as well are one of the reasons why Australians tend to be a bit slow to pick up on this technology. So I do think that it will depend on how quickly the technology does progress through the rest of the world to get those scale efficiencies in production, like we've seen with the rest of technology in terms of flat-screen TVs. So depending on how quickly and rapidly that technology progresses and gains efficiencies, which from early indications seems fairly fast, I guess that that's sort of the delay to bringing things to Australia as well.
Excellent. We've probably got time for one more.
Hello, this is Carlos from Quantium Consulting. Just we're talking about driverless vehicles. What about anti-collision vehicles? So there's a lot of, we haven't touched on that, because do you think that that'll be a quicker take-up than the driverless vehicles when there's like, they kick in to avoid collision or avoid, you know, lane cutting or avoid stopping or when you fall asleep? Can you comment on those?
That would definitely be an interim step that's quite realistic. And we do actually have technology these days for cars to, well, obviously, as Jenna said, there are cars now that can detect a potential collision. And especially cars, pretty much everyone has ABS, as Scott pointed out. ABS is actually the car basically, saying, you're braking the wrong way, it's going to go out of control, it's not going to work, let me take over for you. And anti-collision would be just a natural step towards safer driving.
Okay. Not quite sure we've got time for what. Actually, still got a couple of minutes. Let's go for it. Last question.
Hey, Nick Whitlock here from Suncorp. I think there's an interesting analogy with driverless cars and commercial planes. So you've got your commercial pilots are pretty much a fail-safe autopilot most of the time. Is there also an insurance analogy here? So what's the insurance landscape for commercial planes, and is there an analogy there?
And flying cars for that
matter. Yeah, we'll be in the Jetsons soon. So I think that obviously we do know that commercial planes are largely, I think Catherine can speak on this from experience, are largely automated. And I do know that probably the public is not so aware of that, and to me that's sort of the point that would be nice to start making, that there is these sort of things. In terms of insurance for commercial planes, I haven't been involved in anything of that scale, but I'd imagine that that would be quite interesting to look at and see if there are correlations. I think the difference there is in terms of bringing it from the commercial down to the personal, and also in terms of that public knowledge in terms of the automation as well, and the fact that a commercial plane, you've still got a lot of people safeguarding that system who are highly trained, and you've got watchtowers and all sorts of things. I don't know that anybody will be looking over Google cars with that amount of rigour either, so I think it would be an interesting case study, but there's definitely a few different thoughts that would need to be put around it as well.
All right, with that, I might ask you to put your hands together for our presenters one more time. And I'll ask Scott, Jenna and Catherine to come up for a small gesture.